It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We're working really hard on massive tax cuts. It would be, if we get it the way I want it, the largest tax cut in the history of the United States of America. I think healthcare is going to happen and infrastructure is going to happen. You're going to have a lot of exciting things over the next few months. And I look forward to being able to produce it. Let's see what happens. If we set aside the cynics and the critics, we have a chance, and it's a great chance. It lies before us to do extraordinary things for our country in the years ahead. History is written by the dreamers, not the doubters.
Sandy Rios with you. That's a montage of President Donald Trump last night in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, holding a rally courtesy of a special report last night on Fox. People are saying it was vintage Trump. It is his fifth rally since he came to office. He was there to say goodbye to Terry Branstad, who he has appointed to be the ambassador to China. There were 6,000 people there last night, and again, people are describing it as vintage Trump. He said a lot of things that encouraged a lot of people. In fact, some of those things should be repeated. We talk about such bad news, and it's certainly true that the administration has done some really good things. Turning back the Obama regulations, some of the worst are just amazing, whether it be in the environment or whether it be in forcing schools to accommodate transgender students with their bathrooms. Those are just two things. There are many, many, many that I can't enumerate. Construction of the Keystone Pipeline, getting out of the Paris Climate Change Accord, confirming Neil Gorsuch. Those are not small things, and they have all happened since he was inaugurated at the end of January. So he said a few things. You know, he's always saying he's an entertainer. And he is very entertaining. And I, you know, when you think about if Mrs. Clinton were president and you were listening to her every night, I don't know about you, but I just think I'd rather listen to Donald Trump. But he said something amusing. He was talking about his Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and his economic advisor, Gary Cohn. And he was talking about their wealth. And he said, you know, those particular positions, I just don't want a poor I just don't want a poor person. Does that make sense? Well, yes, it does make sense. And I think we have demonized wealthy people. It's really gotten silly. I haven't talked about that on this show, but of course the point is that it's not money that makes us corrupt. It's our view of money. You can be a poor person and be greedy and corrupt and jealous, and you can be a rich person and be a godly person who loves people and gives their money away and helps people. So it isn't having money that makes you wicked. It's how you view your money. So anyway, that's what happened last night. Just another little soundbite of something he said that was encouraging. Here it is.
It would be a beautiful, beautiful thing if we could get together as two parties that love our country and come up with that great health care and come up with that great tax deal for our people and tax reform and infrastructure and so many other things.
Yes, a lot of things. Wouldn't it be nice if we could work together? I just don't know. You know, after the loss of John Ossoff in Georgia, the Democrats are beyond discouraged. There's talk of Nancy Pelosi being removed, but there's no one to replace her. And there are arguments among the Democrats about whether they should move to the left. They are being pushed to do that by MoveOn.org and other entities, but some are saying that's not such a good idea, and we're going to talk about that. But in regard to President Trump, now here is the thing. A lot of good things are happening, things that we haven't really even talked about because the news has been so heavy with events and attempted, you know, slaughters everywhere under the guise of a lot of different things. And the crash of the Navy ship, there are just so many things drawing our attention. But The administration has done some really good things. Here's the counter to that. There are some things that are not so good. And in fact, the health care bill that's expected to be unveiled today is probably not going to be a good bill. We're going to talk about that at great length tomorrow on the show, by the way. And so I hope that you'll tune in because we'll have it laid out for us this morning at 11:30. It'll be the first chance to see what the Senate is actually proposing. And we'll talk about it so that you kind of see what's happening. You have to understand this is still true. And this is really a matter of prayer. The White House is filled with people who are not doing what President Trump wants them to do. Various degrees of open hostility, holdovers from the Obama administration who are trying to sabotage establishment, never Trumpers who want him to fail, people that think they know better than he does. He has really, it's just pretty amazing. And then, of course, you add to that that President Trump is not a conservative ideologue. These views that he expresses, like he did it in the inaugural, are, I think, his gut feeling, but he's probably never fleshed out or thought through these things, and he's spent his life being surrounded by, as Ted Cruz said, New York values. So, and then, of course, he has his family in the White House who are deeply entrenched in New York values, and so you have conflict, and you have sabotage, you have undermining, and so what we're going to get is a very imperfect product. In a lot of different ways, there are going to be lots of disappointments, and we'll be talking about those. But tomorrow it will be healthcare, stay tuned for that. I want to give you a couple of updates. Well, first, I want us to go to Flint, Michigan, because of course you know that there was a stabbing of a policeman last night. Let's listen to this report from Special Report.
The FBI confirming just minutes ago in a press conference it is investigating this incident as an act of terrorism. The FBI identifying the suspect as 50-year-old Canadian man named Amor Fatui. Investigators say Fatui entered the United States from Canada through Lake Champlain, New York on June 16th legally. He at some point then traveled to the Bishop International Airport in Flint, Michigan today, and he stabbed an airport policeman in the neck. The FBI detained Fatui, questioned him, and they have determined that today's attack was motivated by his hatred of the United States.
Stabbed him. He continued to exclaim Allah, and he made a statement something to the effect of, you have killed people in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and we are all going to die.
The attack happening at Bishop International Airport at approximately 9:45 this morning outside of the TSA security screening area. Police say Fatui spent a little time on the first level of the airport, went to a restaurant, went to the restroom, came out of the restroom, dropped his bags, and then attacked 55-year-old International Police Airport Supervisor Jeff Neville in the neck. The FBI described the knife used in the attack as a 12-inch knife with an 8-inch serrated blade. Neville was in critical condition, but was upgraded to stable. Police moments ago say that they expect the officer to be fine and that he is resting comfortably. The FBI says Lieutenant Neville got Fatui to stop stabbing him, fought him to the end. He never stopped fighting till they handcuffed him. Witnesses describe reportedly seeing Lieutenant Neville bleeding from his neck, on his hands and his knees, while a knife lay nearby on the ground. Fatui is being charged so far with violence at an international airport, which is punishable by up to 20 years. He's expected to make his first appearance in federal court today.
All right. Well, that's, you know, my understanding is that the policeman was attacked from behind and stabbed multiple times. And of course, he's just standing outside of TSA doing his job. I just flew through the airport yesterday, and you see all these guys standing around in their uniforms, you know, doing their jobs, protecting us. So this guy comes up from behind him and starts stabbing him. You know, this is where you just wish, I wish someone was carrying a gun and could have intervened and helped the policeman. But they weren't. This guy comes, this Islamist comes across from Canada. Of course, they're able to do that. And I told you last week that the Canadians are allowing amazing numbers of jihadists to come into Canada from the war field because they're being attacked by us pretty aggressively in the battlefield in Syria and other places. So they're returning home because, you know, they got to get out of harm's way. So they're bringing harm back to the west, through Canada. And then, of course, now we know that this guy came down from Canada to attack us and to attack particularly this policeman. And I have to say that Ramadan, that great celebration of whatever it is a celebration of, it's the celebration called the night of power, the night that Muhammad received his first revelations of the Quran. You know, I remember, you may not know this, some of you, depending on your degree of understanding of Islam, that Muhammad received also, you know, this vision with Satan. He wrote the satanic verses as a result of that. Don't think that there's innocence in this. And I reject the notion that Islam is one of the world's great religions. I'm with Franklin Graham when he says it's evil and wicked. And so Ramadan is being, that doesn't mean every person that claims to be Muslim is evil and wicked. Perhaps they just don't know who it is they're serving. But the roots of it are nothing like the faith of the people of the book, as they would call us, the real book, the Bible. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning and the end. There is no comparison, and it is not Allah. And so the night of power is when, you know, this revelation came to Muhammad. And so it's ending this Friday night. No, I think it's this Saturday night. And there have been, in this month of Ramadan, a dozen Muslim terror attacks, including at least 31 dead in Baghdad, in an ice cream parlor bombing, a truck explosion in Kabul that killed 150, an attack on Iran's parliament and Ayatollah Khomeini's shrine in Tehran left 12 dead and 8 lives lost on the London Bridge rampage. What a great month of celebration, you know, of this vision of Muhammad. And yeah, they love death more than we love life. That's what they like to tell us, and we can see that it is actually true. All right, well, there's more talk of course. Oh, I want to give you these updates here. There's so much to talk about today, but this is important. Steve Scalise, by the way, the congressman who was shot by James Hodgkinson in Alexandria, Virginia, on the baseball field, the attempted mass murder of Republicans, especially members of the Freedom Caucus. No one killed, thank God. No one killed, but Steve Scalise has paid a very dear price. He was shot in the hip, and actually the doctor said that his condition was as critical as you can be when he came in. Bleeding, loss of blood. Remember, he lay out there by himself. The others said they could not go out to help him. He was crying out in pain, and they dragged himself out of as much as he could, as far as he could, out of harm's way. But he was losing blood, and that's a very sensitive part of your body where you medical people could explain this better than I, but tremendous loss of blood, and nearly died. He's had several surgeries, but the bottom line is he's been upgraded from serious to fair yesterday. So that's really good news. I was with one of the members of the House that was at that ballpark and was one of the members that James Hodgkinson, you'll recall, asked two members if who was playing on the field. And the response was, well, it's the Republicans, and having no idea that he was going in there to actually kill them. And so this congressman was pretty shook up. Still, well, heavens, it's just been a week. And I think, you know, I was reading, when I fly a lot of times, I confess to you, I don't know, I'm not proud of this. I read so much heavy stuff. I buy People magazine a lot just because I call it my brain candy, just this silly stuff, and too silly sometimes. But I was watching, reading through the magazine yesterday, and there, you know, page after page on Carrie Fisher and her autopsy and all of these pop stars whose names many times I don't even know anymore. But guess what they gave to this shooting in Alexandria and the attack on Republicans? Just like a half a page of text and a half a page of picture. That was it. Very perfunctory, no details. It was amazing to me. So there you go. That's our culture. But Steve Scalise has been upgraded from serious to fair. We're very grateful for that. I also have an update on one of the sailors who died on the USS Fitzgerald, and I'll get to that, I hope. But when we return, Tommy Binion will join us. Tommy is with Heritage. He knows all about what's going on in Congress, and I want to ask him about the effect of this shooting on members of Congress and what it is they're doing right now. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
A boat ride on the Sea of Galilee. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman with American Family Association and American Family Radio. That is a highlight of our tour of the Holy Land when we go on the boat ride on the Sea of Galilee. A special time to be on the very water where Jesus walked, where he spent time with his disciples. And you know, in fact, you're the place where Jesus was. So many sights we're going to see in the Holy Land that are just like that. We know Jesus was here. The trip is in March, March 8th through the 16th. And we'd love for you to come with us. So many places we're going to see you've read about since you were a child. For more information, go to the website twholyland.com. That's twholyland.com. If you want a brochure sent to you in the mail, just call us at 800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, extension 5.
When someone asked W.C. Fields why he was reading the Bible, he was said to have answered that he was looking for a loophole. Jesus Christ had little patience in his day for religious people who looked for ways to avoid obeying God. For example, some religious people avoided supporting their parents financially because they said their money had been dedicated to God, when of course it hadn't. A true sign of love for God is looking for reasons to meet his expectations, not avoid them. There is more joy to be found in serving God with a whole heart than just with half. This is David Jeremiah, encouraging you to get on the road to new life. Discover the pleasure of serving God on Route 66.
Route 66, driving the word home. Log on to Route66Life.com. Start your journey home today.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and Commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
Hey, my name is Aaron Abbs. I am an undecided major, and I'm a freshman here at TMU. And as soon as I came here, I fell in love with the campus. Like, I knew, like, God was calling me to be here at TMU. And, you know, I couldn't get a better education than this. Like, professors who pray before class, who care about your spiritual walk with Christ. You are who you are, and they care about you.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
For the past 6 years, I've been broadcasting this daily commentary, dishing out 60 seconds of homespun conversation for all of us gun-toting, Bible-clinging, flag-waving deplorables. Now broadcasting on more than 500 radio stations across the Fruited Plain. And now I bring you some more exciting news. In addition to my daily commentaries, Fox News is launching The Todd Stearns Show, 3 hours of high-octane conservative conversation. We're about to back up and bring it, America. It's a show where people of faith will be treated with respect, a show that honors those who wear the uniform of this great country. It's going to be a grassroots radio movement, and that means I need your help. So call this radio station right now and encourage them to carry the Todd Stearns Show. And with your help, we're going to make radio great again. I'm Todd Stearns.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
5 special elections happened this year. 4 were discussed as potentially competitive. Republicans won all of those.
All the 4 Republican-held House special elections so far is that in 3 of the 4, in districts where Trump did a lot better than Georgia's 6, the Democrats did way better than Hillary Clinton did, but they didn't win any of them.
They have to seriously reassess their leadership team. They have had essentially the same leadership team since they took over the House of Representatives in 2006. Yeah, they won in 2006, but subsequently would not only lose the House, but fail in 3 successive attempts to try to retake it. Nancy Pelosi has to be asking herself the question, how long is it appropriate to remain at the helm as the top Democrat in the country when they are not able to execute and turn around even winnable races?
Good evening, everybody.
When the results came down in Georgia, a somewhat somber John Ossoff took the stage.
At a time when politics has been dominated by fear and hatred and scapegoating and division, this community stood up.
Whatever they did, didn't work. Almost as soon as the results came down, Democratic Congressman Seth Moulton tweeted, Ossoff race better be a wake-up call for Democrats. Business as usual isn't working. Time to stop rehashing 2016 and talk about the future. On that, Representative Sherry Bustos agreed.
You know, I don't think a strategy to be successful is to fight with Donald Trump every single day. There are a lot of sideshows that are going on all the time in Washington, D.C. And when I go home and I walk the aisles of the grocery store and I'm hearing from moms and grandmas and dads and kids in college, they don't want us to be in fights all the time. They say, you know, make things happen, bring home results.
As a whole, from the governor's mansion to state offices to Congress, Democrats are at some of their lowest levels in years. In state legislatures, Republicans hold a little less than 4,200 seats. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, they haven't had that many since the 1920s.
All right, that was Allison Barber of Fox News. This is Sandy Rios back with you. Allison's kind of new on the scene. I think she's doing a great job, but certainly it is true. I have to say, I'm sort of surprised that we didn't hear more spin from the media than we heard about the result of the Georgia 6 race. It seems like they are sort of having a moment where the Democrats are allowing us to see their discouragement and actually publicly discussing whether they should replace Nancy Pelosi and change their tactics, et cetera, et cetera. So this should be heartening for those of us on the right. But I'm going to ask the expert. Tommy Binion is the Director of Congressional Executive Branch Relations for the Heritage Foundation. He knows all about these things, don't you, Tommy?
Good morning, Sandy. I'll do my best. I don't know about all about these things, but I'll do my best as always. Great to hear from you.
You know what? Do you, in the chamber there, speaking of the House now, do you have any sense yet? I mean, it's really fresh. Of what effect inside the chamber this loss in Georgia is after they spent $50 million. I don't think the Dems sent $50 million, but there were $50 million spent in that race, and most of it was spent for John Ossoff. What do you think their thoughts are, Tommy, about what that meant to them?
Oh, you know, outwardly, it is just spin, spin, spin. It's, well, we did better than Hillary Clinton did in that district, and Karen Handel didn't get as many percentage points as Tom Price did. But I think inwardly there's a real sense of panic. I think they had built up this expectation that they could spend 2 years undermining President Trump and simply attacking him. And it turns out that's an unsuccessful strategy, that voters are looking for a vision for the country, and they don't have one. And so I think underneath the spin, there's a little bit of panic.
Yeah, so the good news for Republicans is that they've won, and for Donald Trump is that the Republicans have won all of these special elections so far. But the not-so-good news is that the people that have won these elections are not necessarily, they are not conservatives, they're not Tea Party caucus members, except for, I think, the guy in South Carolina was, right, Tommy?
Yes, Ralph Norman is a very conservative person.
Yeah, so how about Karen Handel? What do we know about her as she comes to the House?
Well, she's run a lot of races. She's been a politician around Georgia for quite some time. But you know, I think she's kind of a blank canvas when it comes to these federal issues. She didn't necessarily shy away from President Trump. She embraced the repeal Obamacare and tax reform agenda. She's pro-life, according to her campaign documents. That you know that I think she's one of these candidates that we don't know a whole lot about. I think there's some fear that, you know, she turns out to be a go-along, to get-along type Republican, but I would say that's too premature to say.
Well, one thing she did in her thank you remarks is she praised Donald Trump and for his support and thanked him profoundly and profusely. So that's all we know. That's all I know. So we'll just see what happens when she comes to Washington. Tell me, will all of these people be... will they be sworn in separately and just step right in since these are special elections for vacancies? Or will they be a swearing in of all of them at once? Or how will that work?
No, they'll be sworn in separately almost immediately. I'm not sure what the plan is for these two. It'll be, you know, could be the end of this week, could be the beginning of next week. Well, I guess, no, yeah, they're in session next week. So it could be next week. It happens real quick. It's in the well before the House. You know, sometimes they do it during the vote series, so many of the members are down on the floor for the swearing-in, but they'll get started right away.
Tommy, we've talked many, many times about the lack of accomplishment in the House of Representatives. We have certainly said enough about Paul Ryan. I have, by myself, at this microphone, heaped plenty of scorn his way and criticism for getting precious little done for whatever reason, either for the purpose of not taking any risks because of the always upcoming elections in the House, or because there is actually an effort to undermine and to sort of obstruct Donald Trump's specific agenda. But my question is, after the shooting, it's just been a week, Tommy. It seems like these events move so fast. But it was just a little more than a week ago when this shooting took place in Alexandria. And I'm wondering if you have any kind of insight or firsthand knowledge or opinion about how that shooting may have affected the Republican members of Congress and specifically the leadership.
Well, I think there's been a lot of focus on Whip Scalise, a lot of prayers, a lot of thoughtfulness, you know. Team Scalise and Scalise Strong has been on the tips of their tongues all week. I think there's been a little bit of a unifying effect within the Republican Party. A reminder that all of these public servants, all of our elected members, are our brothers and sisters, and they're meant to be furthering each other. I think there has been a fresh reminder that we can disagree about things without losing respect for one another, without making somebody who disagrees with us our enemy. I think there have been some unifying positive effects of this. On the other hand, there are those who have politicized this even further than it already is. That's unfortunate. I think you saw some on the left clamoring for gun control. You saw some partisan comments from Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi even before the baseball game was played last Thursday. So I think there's been some good things and some really negative things, obviously. Some negative direct effects, but some negative indirect effects of the shooting as well.
Interesting.
I think the third thing to say is just to be clear. I mean, I think there is a little bit of a fear now. In some ways, it popped the security bubble, and it's made members, I think rightfully so, be a little more cautious.
I want to talk about that whole issue of guns in just a second, but before we move to that, stuns me, and I'll explain that in a second, when you say they're talking about Team Scalia and Scalia Strong, because, Tommy, I've made statements on this mic. I totally reject that whole response to tragedy when they did Boston Strong, and I just think that it is, I'm speaking as a Christian now, no, it's not because Boston is strong that they survived the bombing. It's when people recognize God, the natural response should be on your knees before God, thanking him that you're still alive and thanking him that it wasn't worse than it was. And that's why it's not like standing up and beating your chest and talking about how strong you are after a tragedy. That just makes no sense to me. But when we saw congressmen on their knees at that ballpark at the game last week, to me, that's the right response. I don't even know who the people were bowing. But I don't know, what do you know about that? Of course, may not be a perfect narrative, but what do you know about how that happened?
About?
The prayer.
About what? I'm sorry?
The prayer on the field, yeah.
I don't think that was necessarily scripted. I think it's just one of those, I think all of the people genuinely wanted to pray together. I think it was a genuine reaction. I think I think that the nice things that were said about congressmen on the other side of the aisle last week, I think all of that was genuine. I think it was all real emotions. The Democrat, the photo that Speaker Ryan referenced that the Democrats were having a practice Wednesday morning of the shooting as well, and they kneeled to pray for the Republican team. And I think that that spirit obviously carried over onto the baseball field Thursday night. So I don't know much more than that, other than it seemed very genuine to me, which is not something we're used to seeing from our politicians necessarily. So it's almost a shame that it needs to be said, but I do think it was a genuine reaction.
Yes, and honestly, the problems we're having are spirit. I know I didn't invite you on to talk about this, Tommy, so forgive me. These are spiritual problems, and only God can really bring unity. Only God can do that. And so when I see men actually acknowledging God, even how imperfect the men are in their understanding of God is, that is the right response, as opposed to beating your breast and bragging about how strong you are, because that is nonsense. We are just not strong. We are weak and helpless, honestly, and I think that's why Congress is probably feeling some fear. They're recognizing that, and it is a good thing that men should bow their heads and acknowledge God at a time like that. But let's talk about policy.
I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, let's talk about policy, Tommy. Let's talk about the gun control thing, because the issue now, I think, is reciprocity, right, whether states should acknowledge the laws regarding conceal and carry. In other words, people that you and I know who live in Virginia especially, can carry guns, but they can't carry them into the Capitol. The Capitol's really, the Congress people and the senators are sitting ducks, aren't they?
Well, at the Capitol, I think the Capitol is a very safe place. The Capitol Police presence is ominous in the Capitol circle. But to be clear, no, outside of, those three square city blocks, they are very recognizable. Sometimes they even wear pins that say that they're members of Congress, and they're unprotected. Now, if they are licensed to conceal and carry in their home state, they can do that. But if they leave their home state, there's no national law to provide for reciprocity. Sometimes one state, that borders another will have a reciprocity agreement with that state, but there is no national law like we have with driver's licenses that guarantees that you can leave one state and drive into another and still have all the same rights that you had in your home state. That's what we have with driving, obviously, but it's not what we have with conceal and carry. That's been an issue since before the shooting, that advocates for the Second Amendment have long wanted a federal law that says if you're licensed to conceal and carry in one state, you're licensed to do that in all states. So that was an issue before the shooting. Now it's I think what happened was a few members suggested that they be allowed to carry guns in the District of Columbia, D.C., the capital, and then the response came, which I think was a good response. Hey, why can't all of us do that? And, of course, that's the law that had been proposed. A member said yesterday that when that was proposed at their conference meeting, conceal and carry reciprocity for all of us, it got a round of ovation.
Really? Well, does that mean you think there's any chance of passing something like that?
They have passed it through the House of Representatives in the past. At least twice that bill has passed the House and died in the Senate. There are a handful of Democrats that would vote for that. I don't know if there's enough to put it over the edge in the Senate. It certainly could pass. It probably will pass the House. I'm not sure what will happen in the Senate.
All right. Well, we have some other things to talk about. I guess we should move to the one that's on the front burner, and that's the fact that the Affordable Health, well, whatever they're calling it now, the ACA, is going to be unveiled this morning, the Senate version, I think at 11:30 Eastern Standard Time. And we're already getting kind of hints about it. Tommy, what do you know? You know what? We're going to run out of time for this segment. Are you going to be able to stay with me just a little longer?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Because I want to talk about that. And I also, of course, want to talk about tax reform, tax cuts. I want to talk about the August recess, and other things. So Tommy Binion, again, is my guest. He's with Heritage. He's the director of congressional and executive branch relations. And he knows a lot of stuff. That's why I ask him to join me a lot, because Tommy has great insight. So we'll be right back with that discussion. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Corner. Nimis Quinn Melanson Golden is the newest star to hit the Canadian drag queen scene. He's an 8-year-old boy. After taking voguing classes, he showed up at the Work the World drag tour when it stopped in Montreal. Nimis says he started wearing girl stuff at 3 years old, and he started dressing in drag at 7. And who is it that does his makeup, you ask? His mother. Of course, the sexual deviancy crowd hail this as forward-thinking, progressive. But make no mistake, this is child abuse.
Visit the Hamilton Corner on the podcast page at AFR.net. For more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Hello, I'm Gary Roby, host of Call to Worship, heard each Sunday on American Family Radio. This one-hour program will lead you in a special time of worship and praise. We will focus on God's Word, spoken, and in music. Call to Worship has a different topic each week as we glorify God together. Be sure to join us at 5 a.m. Central each Sunday for a Call to Worship right here on American Family Radio.
David Butts of Harvest Prayer Ministries challenges us to see prayer as a gracious gift from God.
Show us, Lord, how to pray with greater effectiveness. Lord, help us to understand more of your heart in our city, in our churches, in our nation, literally around the globe.
The Gift of Prayer is a powerful new DVD that teaches us the importance of prayer. It's a great resource for your church or family. Available for purchase or download from the AFA Cultural Institute at afastore.net.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. We're going to be going back to Israel in March, March 8th through the 16th, and we'd love to have you come with us. You know, one of my favorite places to go in Jerusalem is Gordon's Calvary, which is the place where they make the case, a very strong case, was where Jesus was executed. Then we'll also see the Garden Tomb, which is right next door to that, where also a very strong case can be made, was the tomb where Jesus was buried and where he rose from the dead. Well, that's just two of the places we'll see on one day in Jerusalem. We'd love to have you come with us. If you want the information we have available on the tour, go to the website twholyland.com, twholyland.com, for a free brochure sent to you in the mail. Call 1-800-FAMILIES, option 5, 800-FAMILIES, option 5.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Saudi Arabia's King Salman has just elevated his son, Mohammed bin Salman, widely known by his initials MBS, to be their country's new crown prince. It's early to guess what this ambitious young man's designation as the king-in-waiting portends for the House of Saud and its kingdom's relations with enemies like Iran, former friends like Qatar and the Islamic State, and what amounts to an emerging modus vivendi with Israel. Donald Trump seems to have bet that MBS will end the Saudis' persistent double-dealing. The president's recent visit to Riyadh signaled his confidence that the young prince is indeed committed not only to reforms at home, but to improved relations with the United States as well. So test the prince. For starters, insist that Saudi Arabia reveal and terminate its support for the jihadist Muslim Brotherhood worldwide, including here. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
It would be a beautiful, beautiful thing if we could get together as two parties that love our country and come up with that great health care and come up with that great tax deal for our people and tax reform and infrastructure and so many other things.
That was, of course, President Trump at his rally in Iowa last night, attended by 6,000 people. It's, that's a good thing when he goes out and talks to the people and gets out of that swamp. He talked about it, and of course it is true, and it is a swamp, I have to tell you. It's a very difficult place to live and work, especially when you are under the microscope that he's under, and people just hate you. are trying to sabotage or undermine you or you and your family. Can you imagine living that way? And so it's good for him to get out among the people and be encouraged by their applause, their smiles, and actually be sort of in the real world. Must be a breath of fresh air. Tommy Binion is my guest. Tommy's with Heritage Foundation. He works with Congress and the executive branch, and especially Congress. Tommy worked on the Hill for a number of years and so understands the inner workings of what's going on there. So, Tommy, with that, this morning we're supposed to hear what the Senate's version, which they've kept under wraps, of the health care bill is going to look like. What do you know about that?
Well, I'll say all the reports are unverified. You know, when we did this in the House, we had a leaked draft that came out that was totally different than the draft that ended up coming out. Last night, the Washington Post got a hold of a draft that they think is the Senate bill that's going to be revealed today. It's fairly close to the AHCA, the bill that passed the House, but it moves towards the center in almost all four of the big categories. I think of Obamacare in four parts. It's a federal mandate to buy insurance. It's federal regulations that define what that insurance you're required to buy is. It's a Medicaid expansion. And it's a subsidy for insurance. So on the mandate front, the House bill repealed the mandate. We expect the Senate bill to repeal the mandate, no problem. That's taken care of. On the regulations front, the House bill created a state option waiver so that the states could opt out of certain the most onerous regulations within Obamacare. The Senate bill, that's a little too conservative for the Senate. So what they're planning on expanding a set of waiver options that it was already in Obamacare rather than repealing Obamacare outright and replacing it with this state option. They're gonna use the option that's already in Obamacare and expand it slightly. On the subsidy, the House bill is a brand new tax credit that's age rated and it increases as you get older, as your health care gets more expensive. The Senate bill, it's pretty close to the tax credit / subsidy that's already in Obamacare. And then on the Medicaid expansion, the House Medicaid expansion, it was a phase out until 2020, both on the share that the federal government would pay and the population that's eligible to receive Medicaid. The Senate bill, again, it moves towards the center away from the House bill. It's a 7-year phase out of the Medicaid expansion. So, this bill, like I say, it has moved towards the middle, towards the left from the House bill. And the other thing to point out, I don't know if it has the votes. I can't see if the vote were tomorrow, I can't see there being 51 Republican votes for this bill. So it's all going to play out over the next week, and we'll see.
Well, of course, you've got we've got Rand Paul, and certainly we have Mike Lee and Ted Cruz and Murkowski, I think, from Alaska. I believe, of course, Tommy, I'm not tracking this as closely as you are, but it seems to me those might be potential no votes on this, and there may be some others in the Senate. But the thing of it is, they have to pass it in the Senate. And they're going to do this on reconciliation, right, with only 51 votes. That's what they hope to do.
That's correct.
Yeah,
yep.
So if it passes, then it goes back to the House. And we all know what a fight it was in the House to get that first bill passed. What do you think the House, what will Speaker Ryan do with this bill, you think?
You know, if a bill passes the Senate, there will be enormous pressure on the House to pass that exact same bill. As tough as it was to pass the AHCA through the House, it is a steeper hill, a tougher climb to pass it through the Senate. And I think, so I think if a bill were to get through the Senate, and we're a far cry from that right now, but if that were to happen, the pressure on the House to pass that bill would be enormous. If that were to happen, that would mean the Senate would only have to vote once. Any other option means the Senate has to vote again. If the House changes the bill at all, the Senate has to pass that bill exactly as it was passed in the House, or if they go to conference, both chambers have to pass whatever the resulting bill from the conference committee is. So I predict that Republican leaders think the easiest path forward is to ram it through the House. And then, of course, it would be up to the Republican members whether or not they saw a problem, a hill they wanted to die on, so to speak, within the Senate bill. I would say one of those would be the pro-life concern. The House bill had very strong Hyde Amendment protections in it. There's some question as to whether or not the Senate bill will have that because of the reconciliation rules. So there'll certainly be some legislative provision that attempts to protect us from subsidizing abortion. But we'll see how strong that is. And if it's not very strong, I would say that would be one indication that the Senate bill would never pass the House.
Well, and of course, this is going to bring enormous pressure on that subset of the House known as the Freedom Caucus, who already spent expended so much of their blood, sweat, and tears, and also were so roundly criticized by the president and came under such fire that, you know, one wonders if they have the will to do that again.
Yeah, I think they do. I think that they are people who are convicted. They really don't have a choice when they're taking these stands. They're doing so as a matter of conviction, not as a political calculation. It's hard to stand in the breach like that. It's hard. But I think if there is a real problem with the Senate bill, you can expect the Freedom Caucus to block it. But it may not be a real problem. It may be a matter of preference rather than principle. And in that case, I think you're right. There'd be a big pressure on them to pass it.
Well, when we talked last, Tommy, on air, we didn't really expect that much would be done because the congressional calendar was so short. There just weren't enough days. They had scheduled in so much time off for themselves, in addition to just lacking the will, it seems, to push anything through. But things have shifted a little bit. And the Freedom Caucus, speaking of them, has been calling for this August recess, this 30 days off, at least 30, of both chambers to be, forget it, stay in town and do the work of the people. So what's the status of that?
Well, it's 42 days. At the moment, the Freedom Caucus took that stand about 2 weeks ago. Then early this week, there were as many as three Republican senators talking about canceling August recess. And I think that's where it will stay until a Republican leader, maybe Speaker Ryan, although I think that's really unlikely, but possibly President Trump. If President Trump were to say he wanted to see August recess canceled or even make a gesture in that direction, I think that would really give this effort momentum. But I think it's a really meritorious effort. Think about it. 42 days off in the middle of August when you haven't done anything. You know, unified control of the Congress and the White House is fleeting. It only lasts 2 years, guaranteed. And August is 8 months into the year, and you haven't accomplished anything. So that's a third of the time that they're going to guarantee to be in the majority, and they haven't accomplished anything. And so taking off the month of August just doesn't make any sense in that context, because they constantly make excuses about, well, we don't have time to do this, or there isn't time to do that before the deadline. Well, there'd sure be a whole lot more time if they stayed in town and worked.
Mm-hmm. I think it was spring that the Easter break. I can't remember what crucial thing was being discussed at Easter, because it just becomes a big mush. But it's the same kind of thing. Urgency was the budget, I think, and the debt ceiling or whatever. And it was just all kinds of things that needed to be discussed. But they had to have their long break at Easter. And someone we both know confided that one of, I believe, the leaders confided to them that, we can't stay in town. My wife would be so upset with me. We have plans. We're going to go do something. We're, We have this trip planned. And that really is the truth of it, isn't it, Tommy? There's sort of a, there is an atmosphere of elitism in Washington that where, and it, and I don't really, when people reach a level of accomplishment, I don't mind them having extra privilege than some of us. But when the house is on fire, they need to be bailing water and taking it seriously. And that kind of sort of helps us to understand why this August recess is something they could give up, couldn't they?
They absolutely could. And in President Trump's inaugural address, he said something like, the time for empty talk from politicians has passed and the hour of action has arrived. I wish that had come true already. It hasn't come true yet. And if those Republicans believed that, then they need to not take this time off. So I would say that the Freedom Caucus's position has given rise to the occasion that this is now a decision that they have to make, whether or not to take recess off. And so I think some pressure in the media and some pressure from inside the Congress will mean that at some point the Speaker will have to make a decision and then announce we're either going through with it or we're not.
Would one House stay and the other leave?
Well, that's unconstitutional. So it's one House cannot adjourn for more than 3 days without the consent of the other.
Okay.
So it's very unlikely we would, you know, the worst case scenario, we would see the House in and then the Senate do like a pro forma session or something like that. But because of that provision in the Constitution, it's very unlikely that that one House is in and the other's not.
Okay, one last thing, and we won't have time for a full discussion of this, but I'm curious if you think the whole business of tax reform and tax cuts will be as complicated and difficult as health care reform.
In a word, yes. That's how fractious the Republican Party is, and that's how big the scope of that project is. There is just so much that we agree on. But all around the edges, around the margins, there is so much to disagree on that I hope it won't be as drawn out. I hope the process won't take as long. But I certainly think it'll be just as complicated.
All right, Tommy, listen, I appreciate so much your time and your talent and your insight always. Tommy Binion, Heritage Foundation. Thanks, Tommy.
Thanks, Sandy. Great to hear from you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. All right, I want to close this this show with this update on one of the sailors killed in the USS Fitzgerald. This is an article from the Business Insider just yesterday. One of the seven sailors who died aboard the USS Fitzgerald saved more than a dozen of his fellow shipmates before he ultimately lost his own life. When the Fitzgerald collided with the merchant ship, 37-year-old fire controlman First Class Gary Leo Rim Jr. leapt into action. The Fitzgerald was struck below the waterline, and the Rims Jr.'s family was told by the Navy that he went under and saved at least 20 sailors. But when he went back down to get the other six, the ship began to take on too much water, and the hatch was closed. And so he was 37 years old. He called the other sailors on there his kids. He used to have them over to his house, and he gave his life saving them. And that just shows us, you know, remember the scripture that no greater love hath man than this, that a man laid down his life for his friends. Those are the kinds of people that are still present in this world, in the Congress, in Washington, in the Navy, giving their lives, willing to sacrifice. And God honors that. And God can use men like that to change the world. And I believe he's still doing that. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.